The play you're about to hear is about a preparatory school shortly after the First World War. That will be after 1918 and the early 1920s. My account here, which I wrote just before the Second World War, is not of an unhappy childhood, but of a boy who was sent to one of these preparatory schools, run by a neurotic headmaster, and I try to describe really conditions like a prison. When I was at this school, I always had a sort of feeling, well, when I get out, I'll write something about it, just as a prisoner might think he'd write an account of his prison life.
The Backward Son by Stephen Spender. Dramatized for radio by Pauline Spender. With David Lerner as Geoffrey Brand, Jonathan Adams as Mr. Brand, Kate Binchy as Mrs. Brand, and Simon Cantor as Geoffrey as a boy.
When I was 13, I was sent away to boarding school. My father was disappointed in me. He said I was stupid and slow to learn. Not at all clever like my eldest brother, Hilary. He could not understand how a son of his showed so little sign of talent or intelligence. But I never thought he would send me away to school. I was sure my mother would not allow it. From the age of 10, I started to keep a diary. Every Christmas, my mother gave me a new one, in a different colour. At school, writing in my diary was my only comfort. It was a private world, an escape from the misery and boredom of living with a group of rowdy boys who were silly and often cruel. To me, school life seemed full of pointless rules and punishments which I thought stupid and unfair. But my father questioned my assumption that life should be fair. "My dear boy, nothing in life is ever fair. If it were, all the villains would be punished and the good people rewarded. And I can assure you that very seldom happens." After both my parents died, within a few months of each other, my grandmother appointed a close family friend to be our guardian until we could be independent. This woman was kind and intelligent. She realized how important it was to find some sort of balance and continuity in our lives. She encouraged us to talk about the past, not to reject it. Recently, inside an old cabin trunk in the attic of our house in Hampstead, I discovered my schoolboy diaries and began to read them. I wanted to write about myself as a schoolboy. I thought it might help me to understand some of the problems of growing up with a family you are supposed to love and respect because you happen to be related. As I read the diaries, I was back again in that strange life of an English boarding school for the sons of gentlemen. When I discovered how mean and cruel some of these sons could be, I remember wishing that my father had sent me to a different kind of school, where the boys were sons of non-gentlemen. On my last morning at home, I spent most of the time sliding down the banisters. When I'd slid down two flights, I walked up to the third floor and started all over again. I loved the sense of danger when I spread out my hands, using my fingers as brakes. It made me feel dizzy. I wondered what would happen if I forgot to brake and landed on the stone floor at the bottom of the stairs and cracked my skull. I certainly wouldn't be in a fit state to go to school. After that, I went into the garden to talk to the dog. I could say what I liked to him. All he wanted was for someone to throw a ball, which he could retrieve again and again.
"You are a silly. The ball is over there, by the garden wall. Go on, get it. Good boy. Your life is so simple, isn't it? No one's going to send you away to a strange place where they'll beat you, and you'll meet a lot of other dogs who won't like you and will probably tear you to pieces."
"Geoffrey! Where are you? Geoffrey?"
"I'm not listening."
"Come here! I want you!"
"I'm not going."
"Geoffrey?"
"I will write then. I'm coming. Give me a chance."
"Hello, Mrs. Harding."
Are you ironing my things?
Yes, my love. Your mother's been calling you. Didn't you hear?
I was in the garden.
What were you doing? Mooning?
Talking to the dog.
And what did the dog say?
Don't be silly. Dogs can't talk.
Oh, I beg your pardon. There, my love. All your clothes washed and ironed and marked with your name tapes. Geoffrey Brand. Oh, you will be smart.
I'd much rather be at home wearing old, dirty clothes.
Geoffrey! Are you down there?
You'd better go, love, or there'll be ructions.
I don't care if there are.
Oh, dear. You are in a bad way. Remember, nothing's ever so awful as we expect it to be. In no time at all, you'll be back home for the holidays.
That's 100 years away.
Geoffrey, darling, where have you been? We'll have to leave soon after lunch. Your train goes at 3:30.
I wish I wasn't going.
Darling, I don't want you to go. You know that. But I'm sure you like it. And as Daddy says, it'll do you a lot of good.
Why is it always unpleasant things that are good for you? Why can't nice things be good too? If I'm miserable, it'll be very bad for me.
Oh. You'll soon settle down. Mrs. Leather, the headmaster's wife, says Tislethorpe School's just like home. She thinks of the boys as her children. Daddy wants to see you in his study. And then we'll have lunch, Mrs. Harding. Mm-hmm. All right?
My father's study was where we went to be lectured, told to mend our ways and pull ourselves together. Usually my father sat at his desk in a swivel chair. If he was in a good mood, he'd turn round and look at you. If he was cross about something, he sat with his back to you, pretending to be busy.
Come in, Geoffrey.
That day was different. My father was standing in front of the fire, waiting for me.
I thought it would be a good idea if we had a chat together. This is an important day for you, making a fresh start and so on. We're expecting great things of you. Geoffrey, will you please pay attention?
I am. Staring at the carpet helps me to concentrate.
Don't quibble. Now, listen to me. In spite of all the evidence to the contrary, your mother and I do not think that you are really lazy and stupid, but you'll have to justify our confidence in you. Now, stand up properly, shoulders back. Mm-hmm. No need for all that. Do you know why we had to take you away from your other school?
Because I was backward?
Mm-hmm. That was one of the reasons. But what really worries us is that you don't seem to be as clever as Hilary and Christopher.
What about Hilda? Is she clever?
She's a girl. It doesn't matter so much.
Why not?
Don't argue. The headmaster at your last school said your attitude was altogether too casual, as if you didn't care.
I'm your son. It's not my fault if I wasn't born clever.
Well, that's as may be, but you have two great lessons to learn. Discipline and concentration. I got a scholarship to public school and to Oxford and a first in greats. If I can do that, then so can you. Will you promise me one thing?
Yes.
You haven't heard what it is yet. I want you to promise me to do your very best at your new school.
Yeah.
Then that's agreed. We'll say no more about it.
In the taxi on the way to the station, my mother held my hand and talked about the Christmas holidays and what fun we'd all have. For me, that was a lifetime away, and I began to cry. My mother begged me to stop, or she'd start, and wouldn't we look foolish arriving at the station in tears? We found the platform for the Tislethorpe school train. My mother left me there while she went to get my ticket. I remember how desolate I felt as I watched her disappear into the crowd. I prayed that something awful might happen which would prevent me from going to school.
Please, God, could you arrange a disaster? A small explosion or a train crash so that the trains won't run and I shan't be able to get to school.
When my mother came back with my ticket, we walked through the barrier and along the platform. I saw a group of boys giggling and pushing each other. They wore grey shorts and jackets, and TS was embroidered on the breast pocket of their blazers. The man with them looked like a headmaster, but he behaved like a big, laughing schoolboy. I remember thinking that my mother was going to leave me in the charge of this man. She'd return to our red brick Hampstead house, to the dog and the cat, and Mrs. Harding. Even if she had troubles of her own, nothing could be so awful as the fact that I was leaving home. My mother put on her best hostess manner and went over to the headmaster.
Leather, are you the headmaster?
Yes, indeed, dear lady, that is exactly who I am. And you are?
Mrs. Brand, and this is my son, Geoffrey.
Geoffrey.
Boys, boys, of course, Mrs. Brand, delighted to meet you.
I'm afraid my son is rather sensitive. He takes after his silly mother. You will look after him, won't you?
There's no need to worry. We do have some experience of that type of boy. Cheer up, old fellow. You'll soon settle down. Now then, boys, time to say goodbye. In you get.
Goodbye. Please write. Love to everyone and the dog.
Oh, take care, darling. We'll see you soon.
And the fruitcake.
See you at half term.
Bye. Bye. Safe journey.
Hello.
Hello.
You're Brand, the new boy, aren't you?
Yes.
I'm Fallow. I know how you feel. The first day's always the worst, but it does get better.
When the train began to move, I'd given a last feeble wave to my mother, clenched my fists, and bitten my tongue so that I wouldn't disgrace myself by crying. There was a photograph above the seat opposite me. It was of Brighton Beach and the sea, showing people bathing in blissful freedom. I wished I was there, diving into the waves, feeling the salt spray on my lips. The headmaster was sitting in the corner seat below the photograph, and I couldn't help staring at him. His hair was plastered down with brilliantine. He had a beaky nose and a large mouth with a jutting lower lip which made him look like a boxer. His skin was like red leather. I wondered if that was how he got his name. His eyes were intensely blue, and as I discovered later, he could stare at you without blinking for longer than anyone I had ever met. But now I was staring, and that was a mistake. Mr. Leather made me stand up in front of the other boys, and giving me a playful dig in the ribs, he felt my biceps.
Well, boys, I expect you already know that this is our new boy, Geoffrey Brand. Quite tall, isn't he? How old are you, Brand?
13, sir.
Might make a useful goalie, sir.
Yes, Palmer, you're right. I think he would. Brand, I'd better introduce you to your colleagues. That chap who's just spoken is Palmer, our head boy. The object sitting next to him is Lawton. You look pretty glum. No waterworks, I hope. That boy sitting near the window is Like.
Like what, Brand?
I don't know.
Like, of course. That's his name. Brand's a funny name. How do you spell it?
B-R-A-N-D.
What's your father?
A politician.
Oh, what party?
Liberal.
I'm conservative. Are you Oxford or Cambridge?
Oxford.
Boys, I hope you all realize what a privilege it is to have a university education. Well, do you?
I think so, sir.
There is a kind of secret Freemasonry amongst university graduates. No matter where you are, in the tropics, the Middle East, even perhaps at the North Pole, it doesn't matter where, it's always an asset.
You are so gangly, Geoffrey. Stand up straight. Shoulders back. Don't fidget. Justify our confidence in you. Pull yourself together.
Mrs. Leather and a teacher called Miss Higgins met us at the station. Mrs. Leather had fair, fluffy hair. Her cheeks were powdered white, and I thought she looked very smart. She and Mr. Leather drove off in their Ford car and left the two groups of boys to be escorted by Miss Higgins. We walked along dull, grey streets, and all the houses looked the same, except that their names were different. Anchorage, En Pension, El Dorado and Mont Repos. I longed to know what kind of people lived in such houses. I couldn't think of anything to say to Miss Higgins, so I walked in silence.
Personally, I'm always very glad when term begins because I suffer from melancholy, particularly when I'm on my own in the holidays. You'll soon feel at home at Tisselthorpe. Everyone does. To tell you the truth, some of the boys here are not quite the sons of gentlemen. As your father is undoubtedly a gentleman, we are relying on you to have a good influence.
As no one ever before had relied on me for anything, I was touched and grateful for Miss Higgins' confidence, and hoped I wouldn't let her down. When we arrived at the school, Mrs. Leather shook each of us by the hand and said a few words. Miss Higgins told me to follow the boys into what she called the changing rooms, where they kept their tuck boxes and football boots. Mrs. Nightingale, the matron, came in with our supper on a tray. Thick slices of bread, covered with a thin film of margarine and watery cocoa. She was smoking a cigarette through a long holder, and as she put down the tray, cigarette ash fell on the food. Lawton was crying into his mug of cocoa. I wanted to do the same, in sympathy. Then the headmaster came in, and I concentrated on him.
Beginning of term appetites, I see. Been stuffing yourselves with cakes and puddings during the holidays. Geoffrey, just to explain, it is our custom to have a short interval of prayer in the school chapel after supper.
Yes, sir.
Lawton, as you don't seem to be able to make up your mind whether to blub or snigger, you'd better come and see me in my study after prayers.
In the chapel, for the first time since I'd arrived at the school, I felt a kind of warmth and radiance. I began to think of the boys as us, myself and them against the school, instead of me against the whole of them. I knew that whatever happened, I must avoid meeting Mr. Leather's eye. I bowed my head and closed my eyes, pretending to be absorbed in prayer.
The Lord looketh down from heaven upon the children of men to see if there were any that did understand and seek God. They are all gone aside. They are altogether become filthy. There is none that doeth good.
Because I could no longer bear the thought of becoming filthy, I opened my eyes and looked at Mr. Leather. I saw his horn-like nose, his piercing blue eyes, and his oiled hair plastered against his forehead. But for a moment I felt sure he could do me no harm. The senior dormitory was a long, bare room with a dark-stained floor, low windows overlooking the street, and one picture. A reproduction of Holman Hunt's Light of the World. Under each bed was a chamber pot, and beside it a small mat. As they undressed, the boys were discussing Mr. Leather and the chances of Lawton being beaten by him.
Yes, well, no, because what, the old boy enjoys it. Of course he does. Whacking is his favourite pastime.
How do you know?
Once last term, when Lawton was being whacked, he turned round in the middle of a swipe and told Leather he was a bully who enjoyed beating boys. So, then he got six more, which brought it up to a dozen. Well, look who's here. Come on, Lawton, be a sport. Tell us how many.
Three.
Only three?
What a twist. They were jolly hard ones, and it is the first day of term.
What were you caned for, Lawton?
Caned? How can anyone be so ignorant, Geoffrey? Remember, Newbud, you're not at home now, so don't behave as if you were.
I'm sorry, I didn't know. What do you say?
Whacked, idiot. You'll be a damn sight sorry if you don't change your ways. Namby-pamby son of a toad. Why don't you write home and tell Mummy how rough and rude we are?
Ignore him. Show you don't care. You'll soon get used to it. Nothing's ever as bad as you think it is.
How could I not care? This was worse than anything I had ever imagined. I knew that from then on, time would not consist of hours or minutes, but of great solid lumps of matter. Games and fighting, lessons and punishments, when an hour could seem as long as a day. I longed for everything that was away from the boys, the dormitory, and the school. I thought with envy of the lives of the most miserable savages in Africa, of invalids, beggars, dying sailors at sea. I was sure that no one could feel such emptiness, such a terrible sense of loss. And then from the bed next to me, I heard Fallow whispering.
Where do you live?
In Haverstock Hill.
I live in Hampstead too. Can I come and see you in the holidays?
Yes, of course. What does your father do?
He's a doctor.
Now then, boys. Time to say your prayers. Then I'll turn out the lights.
O thou who couldst make mountains to move, if when I open my eyes, thou wilt make me to be at home again, away from this trial, I shall ever be thy servant, and never again sin in my whole life. If you could make these 3 months seem as a day, or even a week, I shall be forever grateful.
That's enough. Time for lights out. Hurry up and get into bed. Sit.
Dear Miss Higgins.
Sweet kind Miss Higgins. Kisses good night.
Give me a kiss. Dear Miss Higgins, I want a kiss.
You silly boys, not one of you deserves a kiss. Besides, that's the privilege of Mrs. Leather.
We don't want Mrs. Leather. Her lipstick comes off on your cheek. Please, Miss Higgins.
Oh, very well. Good night.
Good night. Thank you, dear, kind Miss Higgins.
That's quite enough now. No talking after lights out. Do you understand?
Yes, Miss Higgins.
Bran, I know you're awake. I can hear you moving.
All right, then. What do you want?
Fallow, Light, Lawton, are you listening?
Yes.
Right then. Bran, in order to initiate you into the ways of Chislethorpe House, we have to ask you a few rather intimate questions.
Oh.
That object between your legs, what do you call it? Bran, did you hear what I said?
Yes.
Then why don't you answer my question? What do you call it?
I don't know. Nothing.
You must call it something. Everyone does.
Not really. No.
Go on, Palmer. Tell him.
Haven't you ever heard of the word cock?
No. I mean, yes. Sort of.
Then you're telling lies. You know what to call it, but you refuse to say. We have ways of dealing with your sort, Brand. So you'd better look out.
A lady never eavesdrops. If by chance she accidentally hears something, then she pretends she has heard nothing. But because of the serious nature of the conversation coming from this dormitory, I will have to alter my decision. Don't you realize that all over the country, in hospitals, in prisons, in lunatic asylums, there are men paying the penalty of actions caused by depraved talk, such as I've heard here this evening? And don't you dare think that what you've been saying has anything to do with love. Love is pure and beautiful, like the love of your mothers for each of you. Whatever would your mothers feel if they knew you used such language and entertained such thoughts? That's all I've got to say. Good night.
Do you think she'll report us to Leather?
Shut up, Lawton. Brand, we will proceed with the Inquisition. What class is your father?
What do you mean?
My father keeps a newspaper shop, so he's middle class. Fallow's father is a doctor, so he's higher middle class. And the fat, yellow-eyed daughter of a bitch who spawned the toad over there known as Lawton is a washerwoman. So he's lower class, aren't you?
You bastard!
Shut up or you'll bring Higgy back. Then Leather will come and whack our bare buns. Now, Bran, perhaps you will answer my question.
My father is an MP.
and he knows several lords. So I think we must be first class.
Right. Now all of you shut up. I want some sleep.
After the Inquisition, there was silence in the dormitory. I thought about what Miss Higgins had said, and I knew that she was right and the boys were wrong. The world was divided into the wicked and the good, those who have physical sensations and those who have none. One side of me wanted to be good, but I knew there was another side which needed to be wicked far beyond the schoolboy idea of wickedness. I remember imagining that on the moon there lived a shameless race of people who had never heard of purity. They wore no clothes. Their lives were devoted to pleasures of the body without fear of punishment. My first few days of the term were spent learning the importance of school routine. I realized that all I could hope to do was to persuade my companions that I was not really awkward and stupid. I never expected to come first, but I had to avoid the shame of always being last. And then there was the embarrassment caused by my father's letters. The boy's letters were collected from a green baize letter rack in the changing room. On his letters to me, my father wrote messages from the cat and the dog on the same side as the address, so that everyone could see. My tuck box was too big and the wrong colour. There was also the question of jam. All the other boys had Chivers or Cross and Blackwell, but mine was Tickeridge's apricot jam, which was thought to be unorthodox and uneatable.
Who or what are Tickeridge's?
I don't know. They just make jam.
And he's actually going to eat the filthy stuff. I wouldn't touch it if it was shoved down my throat. I'd spew.
That was the sort of occasion, everyone laughing at me and jeering, when I experienced pure despair. I felt as if my cowardice would split my body from head to toe. It was only because time went on and my body held together that I managed to survive. During lessons with Miss Higgins, I pretended to be absorbed in my work so that she would leave me alone and concentrate on someone else. I imagined that the piece of wood across the bottom of my desk was the accelerator of a car. I pressed my foot down hard, bearing left of Miss Higgins, speeding out of the door, across the playground, and on to the open road to London. And then Miss Higgins asked me what was the third person indicative of the verb to be, and my dream was over. Mr. Leather decided that it would be good for me to do extra work in the older boys' form room while the rest of my class were outside in the playground. I did not like this arrangement at all. Instead of doing schoolwork, I wrote a letter to my mother.
Dear Mummy, I played football yesterday and stopped 3 goals. We won the match against Westring Hall and had doughnuts for tea. I'm writing this letter in the older boys' classroom. Mr. Leather has given me extra work because he thinks they will have a good influence on me. But I would much rather be outside in the playground where I can play football with the rest of my form. I finished my work, and it's boring just sitting here, which is why I'm writing to you. Please, could you ask Mr. Leather if I can play games with my friends? Lots of love, Geoffrey.
Things are full of labor. Man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied in seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. The thing that hath been is that which shall be, and that which is done is that which shall be done, and there is nothing new under the sun. All right, boys, you can go now. But just before you leave, I'd like to remind you that the boarders are the chosen of this school and must set a good example for the day boys. Little can be expected from them on account of their daily contact with the softening influence of home. So you must do your best. Brand!
Yes, sir?
I want to see you in my study immediately after school. Is that understood?
Yes, sir.
Come in. Shut the door. Brand, do you see what I've got here?
Yes, sir. A letter.
And do you recognize the handwriting?
Yes, sir.
Precisely. When I was at school, there was one word everyone dreaded. Worse than coward or bully, and that was sneak. One particular form of sneaking, worse than any other, is the cowardice of appealing to the tenderness of a woman. Brand, are you listening?
Yes, sir.
When does winter time come in?
I don't know, sir.
Do you mean to stand there and tell me that you've never heard of it?
No, I mean, yes, sir.
You're saying that you didn't know that winter time starts next week.
I forgot.
You impertinent young puppy. First of all, you deny that you ever heard of winter time, and when you are found to be lying, you prevaricate. Were you or were you not aware that because of winter time it will be dark?
Yes, sir.
Then why did you write this touching letter to your mother?
I don't know, sir.
Tomorrow, when the other boys are in the playground, you will stay in. You will sit in the classroom and write another letter to your mother, apologizing for telling lies.
Dear Mummy, when I wrote and said that I wasn't allowed to play games with the other boys, I did not realize that winter time would begin next week, so that it would be too dark for games. I'm very sorry. Your loving son, Geoffrey.
I never expected that those letters to my mother would be followed by a long, accusing reply from my father. In the common room, the green baize letter rack was weighed down by the bulging envelope. Whenever I think of my father's letter, I remember my acute sense of guilt, of being an outsider beyond normal standards of behavior. His letter was long, written in large script with a sharp pencil which pressed through the page so that some of the full stops and the crossing of T's and dotting of I's made holes in the paper.
Dear old man, I am writing this in the train between London and Manchester, where I have been giving a lecture. I have had a very tiring 10 days, but I'm writing to you at once so that you'll have no doubt about my reaction to your first letter to your mother. I won't allow her to write because she has been worried enough already, and she is too kind-hearted to say what duty compels me to say. You must understand that written lies are more calculated than spoken ones. A lie to a woman is worse than one to a man, because cowardice is part of that lie. Nevertheless, in view of the fact that you have made a clean breast of it, we'll forget the whole thing, and I shall not refer to it again. Your affectionate father.
That night in the dormitory, after lights out, I remembered everything my father had said in his letter, and I knew he was right. I was a liar and a coward. I didn't really care about games in the playground. I was simply bored, sitting at my desk with nothing much to do. I had deliberately written to my mother because I knew that any appeal to do with my health or happiness would get a sympathetic response. I didn't mean to tell a lie, but I hadn't told her the exact truth. As I turned in my bed, trying to forget these problems, Palmer shouted at me to shut up. Go to sleep, you bastard, or I'll come and thump you. And then, unexpectedly, life at Tislethorpe began to improve. The boy who played goalie in the school team was ill, and I was asked to take his place. Without knowing exactly how it happened, I had a moment of triumph. As I saw the ball coming towards me, I leapt to the bottom left-hand corner of the goal and pushed a ground shot outside the posts where it trickled beyond the touchline. Then I heard the boys cheer and Palmer shouting.
Well done, Brad. Jolly good.
Back at home for the Christmas holidays, I lay in bed on Christmas Eve and wondered what presents I would get the next day. My two brothers, Hilary and Christopher, in their beds either side of me, were asleep, and I wanted to wake them up. I decided that the present I really wanted was a typewriter or a printing set. Then I would get up every morning at 6 o'clock and write My Life by Geoffrey Brand. I imagined my father at breakfast reading from the Daily Sketch. Who would ever have guessed that the author of this astonishing piece is a boy of 30? I very much wanted to be great. If I wasn't, what else could I be? I knew that I would never be able to pass exams like Hillary, or charm people with my good looks like Christopher. I wondered what happened to people like me. Did they have to beg at street corners or sell matches in doorways? And then I remembered that it was Christmas Eve, and I wanted to talk to my brothers.
Christopher, are you awake?
Shut up, you idiot, or you'll wake him up.
That's just what I wanted to do, Hillary. What time is it?
10:25 and 40 seconds, Greenwich Mean Time.
Do you think we'll be awake when Daddy comes to fill our stockings?
If he observes his usual schedule, he'll be due at zero. 1 hour and 34 minutes to wait.
When he does come, do you think I'll be dressed up?
What do you mean? If you can't make yourself intelligible, why don't you return to the condition best suited to your lethargic mind? Sleep.
I mean, do you think Daddy will come dressed as Father Christmas?
You're an idiot.
Why am I?
Unfortunately, by definition, it is impossible to explain to an idiot why he is one.
If I wasn't afraid of waking Christopher, I'd punch your ugly mug.
The low-grade quality of your blood, some of which I once found on a handkerchief and analyzed, is remarkably lacking in white corpuscles. That combined with the curve of your spinal column, as well as your lack of intelligence, would all disqualify you from being able to punch me on the nose.
I don't believe you.
It's simply a matter of scientific observation.
I hate science.
What I really meant was that I hated injustice, and I hated Hillary. He was always so sure, so absolutely certain that he was right. Sometimes I wished I could be him. And then I thought how clever I was to have escaped being someone else. I was glad that I was me. I began to understand that everyone was really alone. Even Hillary, and my parents, and Christopher. Everyone was a world to himself. I imagined I was a fish at the bottom of the sea, or an animal in the jungle, with all the blackness of forests pressing on my brain. And then it was morning, and Mrs. Harding was standing by our beds, wishing us all a happy Christmas. But it always seemed to me that Christmas was an unhappy time, when we argued and quarrelled, and often weren't speaking to each other. The first argument was at breakfast, when my mother was dishing up the sausages. They reminded me of Tisselthorpe, and I was staring at them. My mother thought I was being greedy.
Don't worry, Geoffrey. There'll be plenty left for you.
No control of his salivary glands. That's his trouble.
Hilary, just because I've criticized Geoffrey, there's no need for you to join in.
Just because he thinks he's a scientist, it doesn't mean he has the right to bully me.
Now, that's enough.
It's Christmas Day, and all you boys can do is quarrel with each other.
Typical of a girl, because it just happens to be one particular day in the year, all rational discussion must be suspended.
I didn't mean anything of the sort, and you know I didn't.
Now then, what's all this? If you don't stop squabbling, I'll send you all up to your rooms. You won't have Christmas dinner.
What do you want us to do? Discuss the elements? Christopher, shall I give you a lecture on the weather?
I wish you'd explain why, when I shut my eyes, there are specks of light in the darkness. And when I make the dumb waiter spin very fast, why does the mustard pot fall in my lap?
Well, even your ignorant father can tell you that. It's what is known as the law of centrifugal force.
That is not strictly accurate.
Why, my dear boy, do you question my accuracy?
In the first place, there is no such thing as a scientific law. There are merely observed examples of conditions within which certain results are produced. In the second place, there is no centrifugal force. Lack of force would be a more correct expression.
Oh, dear, oh, dear. Perhaps then, as you are so much wiser than your stupid old father, you will deign to tell us what plans you have in mind for today.
All the usual things we do on Christmas Day? Church, walk, eat too much, give out presents?
Ingratitude and boredom are, I'm afraid, the outstanding characteristics of the present generation.
Here we go again.
After going to church and opening our presents, our father took us for what he called a brisk walk on Hampstead Heath. The pond was frozen over, and Christopher complained of the cold. He said he wanted to go home.
Cheer up, Chris. It's only a short way around the pond, and then we'll all go home. Daddy, why don't you tell us a story so that we'll forget about the cold?
I suppose that in prep school it's necessary to live in a world of fiction, but you might at least try to grow up.
Hilary, you are 3 years older than Geoffrey, and you ought not to mock him because his tastes are less mature than yours.
I was merely making an observation.
A detached observer might comment that it is more natural, certainly more amiable, for a boy to be young for his age than prematurely old. Sometimes I wonder whether you are indeed a child of mine, or a reincarnation of my great-grandfather.
If you choose to exaggerate, it's impossible to talk to you. I'll see you later.
Daddy, if you can't tell us a story, let's pretend we're on top of a mountain in a blizzard.
Right then. Here we go. Now, hold on to your ice axes. Keep the rope well round your waist. Christopher, you go in front. Geoffrey, in the rear, and don't get lost. Keep going, boys. With any luck, we'll find a humble peasant's hut where they'll give us a cup of hot, steaming soup. Pourquoi, they will ask, looking up at our weary and storm-blown faces. Pourquoi do you climb mountains? We wonder why and cannot find a reason. Why do we seek fame? Why do we want to scale unscalable heights? Why, indeed, do we do anything?
Daddy, where are we now?
High up in the clouds. On each side of this narrow path, there is a steep precipice. We are approaching a glacier. Beware of that crevasse.
What shall we do if we fall down a crevasse?
Hang on to your rope until we pull you up, otherwise you'll freeze to death 30 feet below in utter darkness.
Daddy, I want to go home. I'm bored with climbing. Why has Hilary gone so far ahead?
He's my lookout man. He'll report back if there's any danger.
He's not looking out for anything. He's just standing by the pond.
After our Christmas dinner, we all went upstairs to play with our new steam train. Hilary, of course, was in charge of everything.
I shall arrange the timetable and the trains.
And what shall I do?
You'll be station master of Southdown, Christopher. All you have to do is stop the 308 when it arrives and reverse it at 3:15.
What about me?
You, Geoffrey, can manage the points at the junction. A very important job.
Isn't there something I can do?
Yes, Hilda, of course. You'll be the general cleaning lady of the terminus.
Why can't I do something else? You always make me do the cleaning.
It just happens that you're a girl, and it's an observed fact that women detract from the efficiency of the railways if they are given a position of responsibility. There are many things that women can do, such as sewing and cooking and scrubbing floors, but directing railways isn't one of them.
I hate sewing and cooking and scrubbing. Why can't I be a boy?
That is a physiological question which we can't discuss at the moment. But if you like, you can be cleaner general, not only of the terminus, but of the whole line.
Why is that better than doing the terminus?
It is a more important position. You'll be responsible for the upkeep of the platforms and for cleaning the whole line, including the junction.
So why should Christopher be station master and not me?
Being head cleaner may not sound important, but actually it's a far more interesting position than Christopher's. Right. Everyone ready?
Yes.
This is the 308 non-stop to Southdown. It is due to arrive at 3:15. Please don't do that. The rails don't need dusting.
Yes, they do. They're covered in dust.
You're interfering with the smooth running of the railway. Stop it at once. You stupid girl. Now look what you've done.
All right, then I'll dust the engine.
No, you can't do that.
Why shouldn't I? It won't run properly if it's not cleaned.
A, because it doesn't need cleaning. B, you should never clean a train when it's in the middle of a non-stop run. And C, you'll put the boiler flame out.
Everyone else has a job to do. Why shouldn't I?
The others are doing exactly what the timetable requires, and no more.
Shall we be able to manage without a cleaner?
Of course.
A strike has taken place, but it only affects one branch of the service. We'll carry on as before.
Don't do that, Hilda.
You silly, idiotic girl. Give me that broom.
Leave me alone, you're a big bully.
I'm simply trying to introduce a bit of order. There's enough hysteria and inefficiency in this house already.
What do you mean?
Aren't they hysterical and incompetent?
Who are you talking about?
Our parents, of course. Who else?
How dare you say things like that on Christmas Day, too, when they've given us presents and tried to make something special of it.
Downstairs.
Quick, let's pretend we're doing our play.
Quick. Who am I, who in the depths of the forest dwell, mysterious and unknown, and called by humans, Kyodku?
All this shouting, dreadful children, we could hear you from down in the drawing room.
I'm sorry, Mummy. We were just starting to rehearse our play. We didn't mean to upset you.
Oh, you don't understand how difficult it is to be a mother. Why can't you get on with each other?
We were playing trains, and then there was an accident on the line. It was an emergency.
Whatever is all this about? I've never heard such a noise. Now go up to your rooms at once, the whole lot of you. And I don't wish to see any of you for the rest of the day.
It was all Hillary's fault. Why should we have our Christmas ruined because of him?
It wasn't only Hillary. It was all of us.
So, my youngest son, who is supposed to be quiet and well-behaved, is in this too. The fact of the matter is that you're all thoroughly spoiled. Hillary, I shall write to your headmaster to suggest that in addition to biochemistry, he might try teaching you good manners and humility. As for you, Christopher, I think it's time you went to boarding school and were taught some discipline. I shall make arrangements to have you sent to Thistlethorpe School with Geoffrey. And I'm not going to have my daughter slacking. Hilda, I shall make arrangements for you too.
If we're all going to be punished anyhow, why do we have to be sent to our rooms?
I don't want any of your cheek. Now, clear out. Clear out of here, the whole lot of you. Mother's got one of her headaches, and we all need some peace and quiet.
When I returned to Thistlethorpe after the holidays, I had to be interrogated by Palmer. He was as unpleasant as he could be.
How many servants does your father, the MP, employ?
Six.
Oh. Who are they?
The cook, two housemaids, my father's secretary, and a gardener.
That's only five.
And there's my father's valet.
What on earth's a valet?
The man who looks after his clothes and shaves him.
Oh, you mean a valet? How is it your father employs a valet and you don't know how to pronounce it?
It is valet. It's spelled V-A-L-E-T.
Which happens to be a French word and is pronounced valet.
Bran, how do you pronounce V-H-A-L-E-T?
Shallot, I suppose.
I don't believe your father's an MP. Your whole story is a pack of lies. You're to be punished. Lawson, what do you think?
I think you're right.
It's not a pack of lies. My brother Christopher is coming to Thistlethorpe next term, so you can ask him.
Brand Minor? Why didn't you tell us that before?
How old is he?
11.
What's he like?
He's very clever.
We don't want clever chaps here. No one does. Not even Leathery. What games does he play?
He doesn't play any.
Oh.
He's short-sighted. It's inherited. The doctor says that we Schroeders all have bad sight.
Isn't that a German name?
Yes, but my mother's family has been in England since Queen Victoria.
You're half German, which means we're going to have two cowardly Bosch in this school.
Reckons he
don't? No, I don't.
Steve, he does.
Ten times a day. We'll soon forget about her. Thank you, darling.
When two men go into a great high-vaulted cathedral, the moral stature of each finds its true level. The soul of the mean man shrinketh back into itself, whilst the soul of the great-hearted man expands until it fills the cathedral with the glory of God unto the topmost arch.
I must not shrink back into myself. Without this one compelling fleshly sin, how easy it would be to become perfect in God's eyes. I do what no one else in the world could possibly do. I am worse than wicked. I am depraved. Please, God, teach me to free myself from temptation, without which I would truly follow thy ways.
A few days after I'd written this confession, I discovered that my diary was missing from my desk. Then I saw Palmer and Lawton giggling at the back of the classroom. Palmer was reading aloud from my missing diary. I ran up to him and tried to grab it. But Palmer threw the book over to Lawton, who then passed it back as if it were a rugger ball. And so it went on. I was desperate. I bit Palmer on the hand, and he yelled.
Ah! You bloody fool! That hurt! I'll jolly well pay you back.
Boys, whatever are you doing? I could hear you in the common room.
Brand has just bit me on the hand. I'll probably die of lockjaw. Then he'll be had up for murder.
He stole my diary, Miss Higgins, and he was reading it aloud. He's no right to do that. It's private.
Palmer, give me that diary. Thank you. And stop all this shouting. I shall confiscate the book and hand it over to the headmaster. Now settle down to work and behave yourselves.
Then... ah, there you are, Brand. Miss Higgins has given me your diary, which she said you found lying on the ground. Opening it at random, I came across the word God. I read on to see if you'd used the word irreverently. To my surprise, I found that you had not been at all disrespectful. Have you anything to say? Well, don't stare at me like that, boy. Why don't you say something? I must admit, I don't understand what you're up to.
Up to, sir?
Yes, you puzzle me, Bran. Let me explain. You must understand that we English are a strange, deep people who do not like to express our feelings too openly, though we feel nonetheless strongly for all that. However deeply religious we may be underneath, we think it unhealthy to mention the name of our Lord too often.
Oh.
I'll tell you what I'm going to do, Bran. I'm going to stick up those pages of the diary that deal with religion and so on, and you will make a clean start from there. We'll forget everything that has gone before, and I won't refer to it again. Is that understood?
Yes, sir.
The summer term, Christopher joined me at Thistlethorpe. From then on, I felt I'd got a friend and ally. Of course, Christopher was much more popular than I could ever be. He was better looking, and he didn't mind being teased. Mr. Leather gave us a small plot of land in the school garden, where he expected us to grow something useful, like vegetables. I bought a packet of vegetable marrow seeds, and we sowed them. Every evening, we watered them, and as the weeks went by, watched them grow.
They've grown at least 3 inches since last week, more like 4.5. Let me have a go at watering. You're doing it all wrong. You must water the roots, not the flowers. Give me the hose.
No, I want to do it.
Now look what you've done, you idiot. You've trodden on the marrow.
I haven't. I never touched the plant.
You spat when you said plant. Germans spit when they talk. Just because you're here, they'll say I'm a German.
Then I wish I wasn't here. I hate you.
Christopher, do you really?
No.
It's not you. It's Thistlethorpe. I hate this place. Why did they have to send us here? Why can't we leave?
If I stayed on, you could leave. I'm so awful. You could say that you don't want to be at the same school as your brother.
But I don't want to leave if you're still here.
Then we needn't bother about anyone else. We'll come here every evening and talk to each other. Look at that marrow. It's already quite big. Let's write something on it with a nail. Then as the marrow grows, so will the letters.
What shall we write?
You'll see.
Admiral Sir Geoffrey Brand, MP. That sounds very grand.
When you're going to sleep, do you ever imagine what you're going to be when you grow up?
Yes, sometimes. What do you think of?
I'd like to be a famous cricketer in the gentlemen versus players match. One of the gentlemen, of course. If you're not an admiral, what else might you be?
I don't know. Prime Minister, perhaps. Do you think that's possible?
Why not? Then I shall be proud to be your brother.
Soon after this, I had another argument with Palmer about being so bossy. He told me to apologize, otherwise he'd bash me. And of course I refused. Palmer attacked me. We struggled and fought, and the boys cheered. Finally, I forced him to the ground. I was triumphant. But immediately after, I felt guilty at having such feelings. I was reported to the headmaster for unruly behavior, and he gave me a beating. In bed that night, I started to cry at the unfairness of life and the cruelty of the boys. Christopher heard me sniveling and tried to comfort me.
What's the matter, Geoffrey?
Nothing.
Shall I get into bed with you?
Yes.
Is it because of the beating?
No, Christopher. Not just that.
What is it, then?
Everything. I'm not very nice to you. And it's them, too. Leather, Daddy, Mummy. I hate them all.
But they're really quite nice.
What do you mean?
Nothing dramatic has happened. All of this will soon be forgotten. You'll be involved in other things.
I won't forget the unfairness. I'm sure about that. I don't expect you to understand. You're much nicer than I am.
Let's stop talking and go to sleep.
The following term, there was a school production of Julius Caesar, performed in the chapel for the staff and parents of the day boys. Palmer played Brutus and I was Mark Antony. Before the performance, while the main characters were being made up, some of the boys improvised mock Elizabethan dialogue.
What ho, strumpet! Violet, where art thou? My kingdom for a bold voice, how goes it, Thra? Hush, hush! Do not appear! By heaven, I charge you, speak!
Good countrymen, let me depart alone, and for my sake, stay here with Antony. Do grace to Caesar's court, and grace his speech, tending to Caesar's glory, which Mark Antony, by our permission, is allowed to make. I do entreat you, not a man depart, save I alone, till Antony have spoke.
Friends, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. I come to bury Caesar, not to praise him. The evil that men do lives after them. The good is oft interred with their bones. So let it be with Caesar.
Are yet two Romans living such as these? The last of all the Romans, fare thee well. It is impossible that ever Rome should greet thy fellow. Friends, I owe more tears to this dead man than you should see me pay. I shall find time, Cassius, I shall find time. Come, therefore, and to Thassos send his body.
Yes, Miss Higgins, what is it?
A telegram from Mr. Brown. It's their mother. The boys have got to go home immediately.
Geoffrey and Christopher Brand, could you come here for a moment?
Yes, sir.
Now, will you please go out quietly with Miss Higgins? She has some bad news from home. It's your mother.
Come along, boys. We'll go to the headmaster's side. I expect you're wondering what all this is about.
Yes.
10 minutes ago, we received a telegram to say that your poor mother is very ill indeed, and you are to return home at once. I looked at the timetable. Your train leaves in an hour. Mrs. Nightingale is packing your things for you. Oh, my poor boys. If it should happen, as soon as I can, that you have lost your dear mother. No tragedy could be worse than that. Please wait for him until I come back.
Does she mean that Mummy's dead? I'm not sure.
Geoffrey, Christopher, your poor mother is very ill.
Yes, I know.
I think I ought to tell you the truth. Your mother has died. The greatest consolation in my life in times of stress is my mother, who, thank God, is still alive. This means that your father wants both of you at his side. Your promising careers at Thistlethorpe will have to end. I'm afraid it's going to be a hard battle for you to leave this school and break fresh ground in London, a most unhealthy climate. But of course, it's not for me to question your father's decision. I have only one word of advice.
Am I interrupting?
Yes, yes, dear, you are.
I can't let these boys miss their trains. Oh, you poor, poor boys. I remember when I was the same age as you, I lost my own mother. Now, run along to the changing room and put your things in the play box. The taxi will be here in a few minutes.
Hello.
Hello. Would you like a bullseye?
Lawton, don't be such an idiot. Well, sorry you're leaving. We'll have to find another goalie. Good luck. Goodbye.
Goodbye. Goodbye.
Mrs. Harding came to meet us at the station and took us home in a taxi. I kept thinking something extraordinary would happen, but it never did. I was excited at the thought of leaving Thistlethorpe forever. But then I remembered and felt ashamed because for a moment I'd forgotten about my mother. When we got home, Mrs. Harding told us our father was waiting to see us in his study. She opened the study door, pushed us inside, and shut the door behind us. Our father was sitting in front of the fire with his back to us. He turned round and stretched out his arms. I felt embarrassed and didn't know what to do. But Christopher ran to him and kissed him on both cheeks.
My dear boys, I'm so glad you're here. Now that your mother's left us, you children are all I've got. You'll stay at home and keep me company, won't you?
Yes.
I'll need you. I am a broken man. Now, you'd better go upstairs to the drawing room where Hilary and Hilda are waiting for you.
Going upstairs, I was afraid that I might open the wrong door and see her there, naked on a white bed with only a sheet over her. I imagined that her skin would be white, like Lily's. We opened the drawing room door. There were the others.
Hello. Hello. I'm so glad you're here. He was very anxious to see you.
What did she dial?
A perfectly simple, straightforward operation. Then something went wrong.
Will he be able to live without her?
Yes, of course. He'll get over it.
But how can anyone go on living if they're separated from someone they love?
She was even more inefficient than he was.
What's that got to do with it?
When two utterly incompetent people are living together, it follows that if one of them dies, the more competent has a greater chance of survival.
Oh. How are we supposed to behave? Should we talk in whispers?
Of course not. We must present an attitude of restrained cheerfulness.
Can we play with our trains?
Of course, Christopher, as long as we don't make too much noise. But I think we'd better wait until tomorrow.
Then what should we do?
Wait and see what happens.
I'm so glad you're all here. Soon we'll go downstairs for high tea, which dear Mrs. Harding is preparing. Hilary, while we're waiting, will you play something for us?
I'm rather out of practice, but I'll try.
She loved
that piece so much.
Now what shall we do?
Give him a few moments to recover and then go downstairs to eat.
Now then, old things, come along down to supper. Your daddy's waiting for you. Better not say anything about him being upset. All right, everyone?
I just wanted to say that we must always remember your mother. Often when people die, their children won't talk about them because they think it might be disrespectful. I don't want you to think of your mother as actually being dead. I'd like you to talk about her as if she were still alive. Did you know that she left a message for us? When the nurse was busy lighting the fire in her bedroom, your mother said, "I've had a very happy life. She wouldn't have wished us to mourn. When the formalities are over, we'll do lots of nice things together. Go to pantomimes, visit museums."
Would it be all right if we played with our trains?
Yes, yes, of course. Nothing would have made her happier than for you to play with your trains all day.
Oh, good. Hilary, come on, let's go.
Hilda, dear, now that the boys are out of the way, shall you and I go upstairs together and say goodbye to your mummy?
No, I don't want to. Daddy, please don't let her take me.
My dear child, no one's going to make you do anything you don't want to do.
I don't want to see it. I won't.
There. You see? Come here, lovey. No one's going to make you do nothing you don't want to. Whatever else happens in your life, remember this. Don't ever be so silly as to break your heart. Not for anything or no one. It isn't worth it.
I didn't feel like playing trains. I thought of the noise the railway would make on the ceiling of the room below, where my mother lay. I wanted to keep a private memory of her, just for myself, alone. All this I wrote in my diary. It was the last entry for many months.
Now that she's dead, I must never forget her. When someone dies, there's nothing left except what you remember. I remember the softness of her skin and the scent she used. When they had a dinner party, she always came upstairs to say goodnight. Sometimes she wore a golden dress and a yellow necklace with earrings to match. Once when I was ill with scarlet fever, she slept in my room. Before I went to bed, she filled the bath with warm seawater and sponged me all over, and then she'd sing to me. I shall never forget that.
In The Backward Son by Stephen Spender, dramatized for radio by Pauline Spender, the part of Geoffrey Brand was played by David Lerner. Geoffrey as a boy, Simon Cantor. Mr. Brand, Jonathan Adams. Mrs. Brand, Kate Binchy. Hilary, Henry Power. Hilda, Melanie Hudson. Christopher, Patrick Rosenfeld. Mrs. Harding, Joanna Wake. Mr. Leather, Eric Allen. Mrs. Leather, Anne Windsor. Miss Higgins, Melinda Walker. Palmer, Jamie DeCourcy. Fallow, Gary King. And Lawton, Leo Conville. The play was directed by Richard Wortley.
And now Sir Stephen Spender reads his own poem, The Public Son of a Public Man.
The public son of a public man. Old man with hair made of newspaper cutting. A public platform voice. Tailcoat and top hat strutting before your constituents' applause. When a child, my dreams rode on your wishes. I was your son, high on your horse, my mind atop, whipped by the lashes of your rhetoric. Windy, of course. Before I could speak, I had learned my lesson. Better never be born at all than live in this world and fail to impress on time our name, Spender, in letters inch tall. Father, how we pitied those who had let the emptiness of their unknown name fade on a rose and die in secret, far from our trumpeting, posthumous fame? How shall we know that we really exist unless we hear over and over our egos through the world insist with all the guns of the self-lover? And when the weight of all time's darkness presses upon our shattered fall, how shall we know if our lives went markless, that we've lived at all? Father, imagine one day my sorrow at school when I watched the other boys' faces turn from your prize-giving speech. Their tomorrow plastering your yesterday with their grimaces. Then you lay in your grave for the first time alone, devoured by worms, by newsprint forgotten, superseded, pelted down by our generation, still more rotten. When I left your funeral, my face was hard with my contempt for your failure still. But Father, the hardness was a scabbard for your resurrected will. Through my tears, there broke the fire of a prophetic son's anointment, seeking to spread your name like empire. It was then I made my appointment with fame beyond the gates of death. How like an engine now I press towards that terminus, last breath, the bitch goddess called success. Posterity will watch the spaces where, from an incorruptible mime, yours and my names take their places among the tinsel stars that shine. But sometimes I stand as though beyond a wall, outside a drunkard's face, where a child seems hidden. And I remember being lost when I was small in a wilderness, a garden. If I had the key, I would return there where the lovers lie, locked on bright grass. Prisoners and the homeless make me yearn with homesickness when I pass. O Father, to a grave of fame I faithfully follow, yet I love the glance of failure, tilted up like a gypsy's amber eyes that seem to swallow sunset from the evening like a cup.
Sir Stephen Spender was reading his poem, The Public Son of a Public Man. The producer was Marion Nancarrow.